Hello, everyone. We are continuing on with Thomas Manton, a practical exposition upon the 53rd chapter of Isaiah. And last time we started verse 2, which says, "For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant, and as a root out of a dry ground. He hath no form nor comeliness, and when we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him." And he started in on that and went through the words of the verse and then started going through some points. And we did doctrine number one last time, that Christ's meanness or lowness and want or lack of outward pomp and splendor is the great prejudice against the entertainment of him in the things of his kingdom. And that is where we left off last time, coming up to doctrine number two. And Lord willing, we're going to continue on with that for this reading. And I'll go ahead and start that. He says, "I come now to insist upon the second point, which is this, doctrine number two, that though Christ's meanness or lowness be a great hindrance against the entertainment of him, yet it is by the special appointment of God. He shall grow up before him. God orders it that the Messiah should come in such a manner. I shall be brief in handling this point. There is nothing about Christ but fell under God's decree and the special care of his providence. All the circumstances of his birth, the time, the place, manner of every action, you have some instance of it. The counsel of God brought it to pass, and the scripture was frequently quoted that that might be fulfilled which was spoken concerning him. Yea, the most malicious actions of the enemies are spoken of as appointed by God, as particularly their spite to him in his death, him being delivered by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God ye have taken and by wicked hands have crucified and slain. Judas delivered him, Pilate delivered him, and God delivered him. For of a truth, against the holy child Jesus, both Herod and Pontius Pilate and the Gentiles were gathered together to do whatsoever thy hand and thy counsel determined before to be done." Acts 4:27-28. "Whom being delivered by the counsel of God." This was God's grand contrivance. Here was the manifold wisdom of God, Ephesians 3:10. So Paul calls the wise disposition of our salvation by Christ. "Without controversy, great is the mystery of godliness, God manifest in the flesh." This was the great mystery. When a man is to make some rare engine, he will look to every screw and wheel, that all is set and ordered right. Here was God's great masterpiece, in which he would show himself, and the great copy of his eternal thoughts. That is the reason. This point affords us many useful considerations, as this decree of God may be referred, number one, to Christ, number two, to the wicked, and number three, to the godly. Number one, to Christ, God decreed this, and Christ fulfilled it. It is a wonder to see how all things did conspire to make Christ conform in everything to God's counsel concerning him. As for instance, in Augustus, his decree, which caused Joseph and Mary to go to Bethlehem, where she was delivered. It would be too long to give you the history of the gospel. Many providences did meet together that all things, whatever God had decreed, might come to pass. Admire, therefore, the manifold wisdom of God in contriving these things. Number two, in respect of the wicked, God appointed this meanness or lowness of Christ before them. Before them he shall rise up. God punishes sin by occasions of sin. God may be said to harden sinners three ways. Number one, by leaving them to themselves. As it is said, he left the Gentiles to their own ways, Acts 14:16. Number two, by permitting them to enter into them, into sin, he allows them to sin. And number three, by presenting to them such objects from whence their corruption takes occasion to sin, though they were things good in themselves. As Jeremiah 6:21, "I will lay stumbling blocks before this people." The Jews argue that Christ is not the Messiah because he did not come in such a way as to satisfy all his countrymen. God would have Christ mean, or low, that all might not believe in him, though not to cause sin, but to promote his just judgments. So God's cause and Christ's ways have difficulty enough in them to harden them. God pursues his secret judgments upon them. Admire, therefore, the fear and fear God's judgments on the wicked. It was by the special appointment of God that it was so mean or low. Number three, for the godly, God appointed all the meanness or lowness of Christ for their sakes, for whom it is a double comfort. Number one, from the eternity of God's thoughts toward them, Christ, from before all worlds, was appointed to be a captain of salvation through many sufferings and to undergo many hardships for your sakes. This length of love is a great refreshment to the spirit. And when the soul reflects upon this meanness of Christ as the effect of God's eternal thoughts of mercy to it, it is the more encouragement to believe. Christ verily was foreordained before the foundation of the world, but manifested in these last times for you. He would have them established in that as a sure truth. Number two, it is a comfort to them in their meanness or lowness. It is that which is appointed. They shall be conformable to their head, Christ, in this respect. They shall undergo no condition but what God from all eternity had decreed for them, Colossians 1:24. Paul and all the godly are said to fill up what is behind all the sufferings of Christ in their flesh. The church and Christ make but one body. That which they suffer, he suffers. That which he suffers, they suffer. The sufferings of the godly are appointed as well as Christ's meanness or lowness. That's the end of Doctrine 2. I now proceed to the third observation, namely, Doctrine number 3, that this meanness of Christ was willingly taken up by him both in his birth and life and manner of appearing among men. Number 1, in his birth. Point number 1, for the time of it. It was when the royal stock of David was quite extinct, and even come so low that Joseph was but a carpenter by profession. Is not this the carpenter's son? And therefore is the genealogy of Joseph and Mary so carefully sought out by the evangelist, because it was not commonly and publicly known that they were of that lineage. The throne of David was occupied by Herod, who was an Ascalonite. He was, in some Greek words, rather an observer of the tribute than the king, or than a king. Number two, the place, Bethlehem, a small place, not able to make up one division in Israel, the least of the thousands of Judah. A man would have thought he should have been born in some great city, as Rome or Jerusalem. No, but he chose to be born in Bethlehem, and suffered at Jerusalem. He had the least place to be born, but the greatest to suffer in. And then again, he was not born in any stately room at Bethlehem, but in a stable, nay, in a manger in the stable. Christ would have all mean, all things low at his birth. Number three, consider how in everything he was found in shape like another child, being circumcised the eighth day. He submitted to the law as soon as he was born into the world to teach his followers obedience. Number four, consider the oblation that was made for him, such as was made for poor people, a pair of turtle doves and two young pigeons, the poor's offering. Those that were not able to bring a lamb were to bring two turtle doves and two young pigeons, and that was accepted for an atonement. Now, thus much for his birth. Yet we may observe there was something divine still mingled with Christ's outward meanness or lowness, as the appearing of the star, the trouble of the Jews, the wise men's report, and offerings. But these things God would leave them without excuse, and under this poverty discover some glimpses of the deity. Now, point two, now for his life and manner of appearance in the world, he was altogether found in fashion as a man, as the apostle said, that is, to outward appearance, just as other men, for his growth was as other men's by degrees, and Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. Though he had a most perfect divine soul given him at first, yet as he grew in stature, he exercised and discovered the vigor of his faculties, which is there called increasing in knowledge, showing forth in his several ages more degrees of knowledge, that in all things he might conform to us. It would be too large for me to insist upon everything. Therefore, briefly, take it thus. His life was spent in much toil and labor, going to and fro, nay, and probably also in mean or low labor, in his father's trade, Mark 6:3. Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary? Not only the carpenter's son, but the carpenter. In his younger time, he exercised that trade, as Justin Martyr, a most ancient historian, writes. He made yokes and plows, he said. And when he put himself upon the way and duty of his ministry, he was in much want or lack and penury. He was unhungry, Matthew 4, verse 2, thirsty, John 4, verse 6, without house and home, Matthew 8, verse 20, foxes have holes and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man hath not where to lay his head. Yea, so poor was he that he had not wherewith to pay his poll money for his head to the Romans, Matthew 17:27. Therefore, Peter is fain to go to the sea and catch a fish. I will not touch upon those that especially take in his suffering. That will fall in the next verse. Only take notice how he was hunted up and down by the Pharisees, how he was scorned and derided by them, so far as it reflects upon his weakness, as Luke 16:14. They blew their nose at him in great scorn, as the word may be rendered. Nay, when he would show any royalty and come as a king to Sion, he came riding upon the foal of an ass, Matthew 21, verse 5. Now, use number one. Oh, then be exhorted, number one, to admire the love of God that he should stoop to such a low condition for your sakes. Here is a large field for meditation. Expatiate your thoughts, then, and trace Christ in all the history of his life, from the cradle to the grave, from the stable to Golgotha, and see what a mean or low and contemptible life he led. Number two, faithfully apply it and say, all this was done for my good. The scriptures do not only take notice of Christ's humiliation, but of the very end or purpose of it. Most read the history of Christ as a man would do a romance, to be a little affected with it for a time. They take notice of what was done, but not why. There is not that faithful appropriation, Galatians 4, verses 4 and 5. When the fullness of time was come, God sent his Son, made of a woman, made under the law, to redeem us that were under the law, that we might receive the adoption of sons. Mark the end and say, this was done for me, for us is too general. Why was Christ so mean or low? It was that I might be rich, 2 Corinthians 8, verse 9. For ye know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, that ye through his poverty might be rich, rich in grace and rich in comfort. The Greek word signifies he became a beggar, not that he did beg, but he lived in continual need of supply and would sometimes put forth some glimpses of his divinity to command his welcome. Luke 19:5. Zacchaeus, make haste and come down, for today I must abide at thy house. Yet I say, Christ put himself upon this meanness for our sakes. It is for our sakes that he who is altogether lovely in himself had no form, that we might be made lovely and beautiful. He was without comeliness, that his church might be comely, without spot or wrinkle, as the apostle speaks in Ephesians 5:27. He was besmeared with blood that the church might be without spot. It is good to observe that Christ's meanness or lowness was not only in judgment for a stumbling block to the wicked, but in mercy to the godly. If he had discovered his deity at first, he had never suffered, and then the work of our redemption had stood still. It is a good observation of St. Austin or Augustine, quoted by Aquinas. He lists the Latin, I believe it's translated, "If he had done all things wonderfully, he had done nothing mercifully." Christ's meanness or lowness, as it is a great mercy to mankind, see that it be so to you. Use number two is information. It informs us then, number one, that poverty and meanness is not disgraceful. Christ himself was a carpenter, Paul a tent maker, and the apostles fishermen. Christ, you see, scorned that glory, pomp, and greatness which the world dotes upon. Men look upon the outside as if the horse were the better for the trappings, or anything without a man or outside of a man could ennoble him. Proverbs 19:1. Better is the poor that walketh in his integrity than he that is perverse in his lips. A man is rightly esteemed by his internal qualifications. One holy saint is to be preferred above all the rich men that abound in the greatest affluence of estate and pomp. It should be so with all, much more with the godly. It is a reproach to Christ to contemn any man for his poverty because he is meaner or lower in the world than we. Proverbs 14:31, "He that despiseth the poor reproacheth his maker." Can I believe that ever you would honor Christ who despised the poor? Would you not him too? He that despises the poor reproaches his Savior. It is the most contrary affection to the Christian religion. Number two, it informs us that poverty should not be irksome to us. Christ underwent it before you. His apostles were base in the world's eye. 1 Corinthians 4:13, "We are made as the filth of the world and are the offscouring of all things, and counted the scurf of the earth." Christ chose this kind of life, a holy meanness or lowness, and therefore be not troubled. Poverty is a great burden, I confess, and lays a man open to many a disadvantage, scorn, contempt, and refusal. But consider, Christ has honored it in his own person, and he honors it to this very day. If there be any respect of persons with God, he respects the poor and reveals most of himself to them. The poor receive the gospel, Matthew 11:5. "I will also leave in the midst of thee an afflicted and poor people, and they shall trust in the name of the Lord," Zephaniah 3:12. God has provided for the esteem of all his servants. What is wanting or lacking one way is more plentifully supplied in another, so that those that have the least outward esteem are justly accounted the most excellent. Every condition, I confess, has its snares, but poverty has least. This disposes the soul to hearken to divine things, that their outward defects may be made up in some inward excellency. Everything naturally seeks after a supply of its wants or lacks, and therefore, as it is in outward things, persons that are themselves deformed are most deeply stricken with the love of beauty in others, that they may cover their own wants or lacks by linking themselves with that abundance of perfection that they spy in the other people. So the godly poor are more disposed to hearken to religion because more sensible of their defects, that the meanness or lowness of their outward estate may be covered and satisfied for by the riches of those graces that are in their souls. And indeed, as these are fitter to receive a manifestation, so God does most manifest himself to them. The first report that was made of Christ was made to shepherds and poor swains. Therefore, on these accounts, poverty is not so irksome. Now, use number three is instruction. It teaches us diverse lessons. Was Christ both in birth and manner of appearance in the world mean or low? Then, number one, it teaches us humility, that he should empty himself of all his glory and live in a mean estate. The apostle sets out this pattern excellently, Philippians 2:6-8, who being in the form of God thought it no robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation and took upon him the form of a servant and was made in the likeness of men. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. He divested himself of all his royalty that he might teach us this pattern of humility. That's partially why he did that. Most men love to live in the utmost, in a proud, pompous way, and disdaining of others. You see, Christ, when he might have discovered majesty, held forth naught or nothing but poverty. And indeed, it was principally to teach us this lesson, Matthew 11:29, learn of me, for I am meek and lowly of heart. He does not say, learn of me, in Latin words, quia potens, but learn of me, quia humilis sum, not learn of me, for I am powerful, but learn of me, for I am meek and lowly. Christ is not to be imitated in his power, but he is to be imitated in his graces. Not learn of me to do miracles, to create the world, but to be lowly and humble-minded. This is the great pattern and copy that God has set us, to wit, humility. Number two, to be mean and low for Christ, as he was for you. Christ was poor, that you might be rich, rich in peace, joy, comfort, and salvation. Can you find such a rare instance as would be poor for Christ, that he may be rich in his glory, in his ordinances, in the safety of his servants? We have read of many that have been poor for their lusts, and again, usually lusts are corrupt desire, any corrupt desire of the heart. So we have read of many that have been poor for the corrupt desires of their hearts and sins in their hearts. They have prodigally lavished away their estates upon their pleasures. But very few have been poor for Christ. Philippians 2:5, let the same mind be in you that was in Jesus. The apostle applies it to humility, and we may also to the same purpose. Do you have as bountiful a disposition to God as Christ had for you? Can anything be too much for him? If a man truly serves God, he would come as near him as possibly he could. Well, Christ cast away his glory for you. Do you cast away your riches for Christ? Not by avowed poverty, but by a voluntary laying out yourselves for his word, his cause, and gospel. It is not a waste where all is due, D-U-E, and indeed, nothing is lost that is laid out upon God. Matthew 10:39, he that findeth his life shall lose it, and he that loseth his life for my sake shall find it. Therefore, if you do, as Ahaz's dial, go back 10 degrees in your estate or outward pomp, the nearer will you come to the pattern. There is one who was quitted more for you than you can possibly quit or let go or stop doing or leave behind for him. And he says, but I shall proceed to the next doctrine. So that was the end of doctrine number 3. And we're going to go ahead and stop there for this time. And Lord willing, go on to doctrine number 4 the next time. But until then, go pondering Christ's meanness or lowness and his great humility. And may we, by his graces, follow in his pattern, ready and willing to give up all for him. And Lord willing, we will talk to you again soon.